Hello, good afternoon. We're going to call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. We're having a public hearing on two bills today. No work sessions scheduled. We are missing one committee member who has had to go home sick, unfortunately, Representative Barnhart. Hope he gets better quickly. We will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3161, and I'll invite Representative Chris Edwards to testify.
He's been coughing terribly, yeah. You know, I almost said that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state representative in House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City. And let's not forget Cheshire and Alvador.
That's not.
The House Bill 3161 is about improving or reducing the carbon footprint of the construction process here in the state of Oregon, particularly as it pertains to public buildings. It should be noted that this is not about reducing the carbon footprint and or increasing energy efficiency of the actual building itself, but rather the carbon footprint of the construction process. So one might imagine that, say, one may, in fact, have a particular construction project being built in one's house district, perhaps a prison or a state mental health hospital, and as such, one may wish that as many of those jobs were filled locally as possible. And it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination to imagine that the carbon footprint associated with the construction process should the rock and other construction materials, if they were to be brought from, say, Caldwell, Idaho, or the workers brought in from Clark County, Washington, there are going to be higher environmental costs associated with that project than if the materials and labor came from local supplies. So the general concept as being both good for local jobs and good for the environment in the construction process. It's an idea that I think bears a lot of merit. I would like to see us move forward with at least some pilot projects here at the state level. I'm certainly open to how the details, whatever amendments need to be made to hammer out the details. I'm much more interested in the larger concept rather than exactly being wed to how this particular bill is written at this time. And we do have some folks from private industry that can help guide us through this process and provide those services. They'll be here to speak a little bit more about what the process looks like for measuring the carbon footprint of a construction job. And then I hope that we'll have folks from DAS and or other agencies that would be here to testify both what may work with the bill and what may need to be improved. So with that, I'm available for questions, although I'm certainly not the expert on this particular area. So
we'll try them anyway. Representative Booth.
I'll ask the first question, Chris.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How would this be affected by, if you go back to the first of the session, before the session, and I was touting the buy Oregon first, hire Oregon first, and we can buy Oregon first, and that's great. How would it affect the hiring practices if we say the crew must be, the hired crew must be, below this level of carbon footprint or whatever, and only an Oregon crew could meet that? Would that supersede the hiring laws that we have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, this bill would not dictate where folks could come from. And whether or not out-of-state firms could indeed perform construction projects in the state of Oregon. It would simply incorporate a measurement of the carbon footprint in the construction process into the decision making of the construction process. And, you know, I'm saying as a result, it is not too hard to imagine that local firms are going to be more advantaged than distant firms who certainly have a lot more involved in transportation of people, materials, trucks, all that stuff. So,
thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. Good to see you, by the way. And thanks for bringing this bill. This efficient public buildings is a major priority of several members and maybe even more than several members of our caucus. There's a really good bill in front of the Sustainability Committee East, which I know you're a co-sponsor of, that deals with private homes and does really good stuff. And I think this committee is hearing, or at least has before the opportunity to hear, the 3199, which addresses specifically not only the construction process, but in fact the existing energy emissions, what's going on right now with the noise. It's not me.
Just remind folks to turn off their cell phones. That's the cause of the buzzing noise. Our microphones pick those up. So even in the audience, turn them off. Thanks.
And any input you have on how this interfaces with 3199 is great, how these might relate in terms of construction processes as well as doing retrofitting of existing buildings would be great. So that's my question. My question again is, how might those relate? How can we be helpful? That might be a question for hallway conversation later. And then my only thought with regard to Representative Boone's good question was, my first blush thought is that to the extent that green building practices reduced, or other way around, to the extent Oregon-based employers and employees were engaged in doing our construction projects, I would think that would at least reduce plane travel, right? I would at least think it would reduce our carbon footprint to some degree. So hopefully they'd be very compatible. But the first thing was my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about how the two bills would interrelate. I'll think about it. And we can discuss it, yeah.
Any other questions for Representative Edwards?
Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thank you for hearing
the
bill, Mr. Chair.
All right, thanks. And we're going to go next to Ecologist Chris Humphreys from private sector. Chris, if you come on up and we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Chris Humphreys. I'm with Ecologistics. We're a private-based company that has developed a system to do a service very similar to what this bill describes. This business, Ecologistics, is a spinoff from a commercial development company that's been doing business in the Portland area for about 25 years, commercial, industrial, retail, roads, and things associated with that. So we're steeped in the private construction business, and a lot of these projects are kind of built by private for public. So we had a lot of interaction with the cities and various agencies in the process of that. What really alerted us to this opportunity is what we call the Oregon Carbon Challenge, which is the graph shown up above the House Bill 3543. That lays out greenhouse gas emissions reduction goals for the state, and we've tracked where the state's efforts are in the light blue line that's up there and see that there's more that we should put on the table to try to help meet those goals. So we developed a system to understand how construction interacts with the state's carbon footprint and ways that we might be able to reduce those impacts. So I have the four pictures along the bottom here that kind of describe the big four pieces of carbon in construction. The first one is materials. Cement and steel manufacture are two types of materials that are used in virtually every construction project. They embody between 20 and 40% of their cost in the energy cost associated with their production. So the wise use of energy and the use of those materials directly relates to the carbon footprint and creates an interaction between private industry and the industrial sector itself as to what the public wants, and then can cause them to change their manufacturing procedures and products to be less impactful. Secondly, transport. Heavy materials especially require large trucks. They drive long distances. We had an industrial project that used a concrete source that was 15 miles away instead of 3 miles away. And by the time you delivered all the concrete, the net additional miles was over 18,000 miles. And that's just over 3.5 trips from Portland to New York City in a loaded concrete truck. So that's just one part of one project and one part of Portland. We think that these kinds of examples are wider spread. Site logistics, cranes, generators, lighting, all of these things have various fuel options, whether it's line voltage, which is the best, to diesel and other types of combustibles, combustion engines that are less efficient in both how well they work and the amount of pollutants that come out of them. And then worker transport, everybody has to get back and forth from job sites, and many times that those efforts are not coordinated, so there's additional carbon emitted in that process that could be improved through looking at the process through these tools. So we developed a system called the Eco Method, and what the system is it guides you through the process of planning your construction project and selecting all your sources and your plan in such a way as that you have your eye on your carbon footprint and your other goals, and that you're supporting those goals directly through the decisions you make in construction. So first of all, you have to be able to locate your resources. We have tools that help us figure out where are the businesses and the resources you'll need for your project, and more importantly, where are the various choices and what are their footprints, and both economic and carbon. Secondly, we calculate those footprints. We anticipate what one option versus another would be and how much carbon or how much benefits are there to get in one strategy versus another. We can communicate those to the team, and they can make their own decision about what's achievable or practical for their project. Then economic benefits. You know, there are economic consequences or benefits that come from construction decisions. Whether you hire local contractors or not, that money directly goes into the tax system through property taxes and income taxes, and then also the churn, or the number of times those dollars bounce around in a particular community, is directly affected by whether or not those dollars land in the community in the first place. So we are able to differentiate that, give another piece of decision-making tools to the decision-makers so they can do that. And then lastly, once you've made all those decisions with this enhanced information, you can generate your eco plan. That's your step-by-step instruction of what to do and who to hire and how to do it in such a way that you meet your goals. This is a graphic to show the technology and the idea of the local sourcing. And in this case, the trade area was identified as Multnomah County, and you'll see the various icons on the screen represent business locations to the project that was studied in this case. And ultimately you have to decide who's inside the fence and who's outside the fence, and how much better is it for economically to be inside or outside of that fence. And we have tools that can help understand that so that you can determine whether you should reach in a particular case or not. This is an example of a cement sourcing pattern from a project that we did. In this case, the cement was actually sourced by ocean freight from China. Which is, a lot of these commodities are a spot market. They literally buy based on a fraction of a penny's difference in any one moment to buy things, and we found there's a carbon consequence to that, and obviously there's an economic consequence to not buying cement from people that are local. In this case, there were over 100 additional tons of emissions related to the ocean freighter versus getting the product by rail or by highway through more local sources. The cost issue, I know, is going to come up, is what is this cost and how do you deal with that? And the answer is that we don't know exactly, and that's why we want to do some pilot projects, is to determine what is on the table and how achievable are these goals through various strategies. The first piece, of course, the system needs to be administrated, and there's opportunities to offset that cost through Betsy and other programs like that. Secondly, the process of sourcing inefficiently, if you don't have tools to help you figure out how to get that sourced, then you're assuming additional travel costs through the labor, the fuel costs, and the wear and tear, much like the concrete example I used. They had to pay somebody to drive that 18,000 miles and put the fuel in it and everything else. So there's a real cost to not being efficient. Lastly, local economic development, whether you're talking about job creation, saving jobs, creating jobs, the taxes that can come from from those activities, or the risk of perhaps an industry not being viable anymore because they're not able to get enough work and going away, and then you're relying more and more on far-flung sources for the projects that you know you're going to need to build over and over again, is also a long-term threat. And then lastly, we hear about and think a lot about green jobs. Where are they going to come from? What types of green jobs are available? These green jobs are the types of jobs that can be done by architects and engineers and contractors, many of which have really been hurt hard by this recession. I had one architectural principal say that he thought the architect's unemployment rate might be about 30%. So this is... You know, that's a tragic situation, and we need to find, since we're not going to be able to build a lot of new buildings to put all these people to work, we need other ways to do that. This is a way that we can examine what we're doing and put these people back to work and establish our leadership as a state. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Humphreys. Any questions? I have Representative Goody.
Go ahead.
Okay. Just a couple. First of all, I want to get back to something that a question that Representative Edwards, I think, addressed. I want to make sure you believe he addressed it correctly. The question was whether this bill would require the state to use, you know, the low carbon source that's identified by a program like yours. Is it your impression that this bill would then require the state to use that contractor for supplying or for work, even if, for instance, the cost was much greater?
Mr. Chairman, no, this bill doesn't require any particular decision. I was describing the way Ecologistics does business and how we think that sometimes the information compels people to want to make a decision like that. But this is purely to try to get some data to find out, is this a good idea? What things are better than others?
Great. Thank you for that clarification. Is there anywhere else that's sort of doing this? Would we be the first state, or are there municipalities? To what extent is this kind of way of thinking about construction embedded in industry practices or in state government practices or other public practices?
Yes, we're working on this locally with on a variety of projects. So we're working with Clackamas County on an alternatives analysis for a road project where they've been asked to explain how a green county can put a new road through an area, you know, that has some natural amenities to it. And so we're already seeing some of this challenge between the green place that we want to be and some of the decisions that we need to make, the practical decisions we need to make for infrastructure. So we've been brought in to help understand and avoid carbon through that process in hopes of showing that good faith that they are, in fact, a green county. But sometimes green counties need to build roads, too. Secondly, we're working on an affordable housing project in Portland through a specialty housing. It's affordable family housing, about 60 units in southeast Portland. We're helping them understand what their carbon footprint and other goals are and connecting to that. And we're working with a contractor, Skanska, on a parking garage out in Hillsboro for the city of Hillsboro, and we're looking at reducing the footprint of that project substantially through this process, and actually just met this morning to talk through those strategies. So we're getting some early buys there, and we have another group of people right behind them that we think we're very close to identifying a project with, but it's slower than we'd like it to be.
Representative Williams. Well, thanks very much. Oh, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much, I was struck by one of the slides that showed the cost of bringing the cement in from Canada as opposed to Durkee, which happens to be in my district, so it kind of caught my attention, particularly since it was more expensive to bring it from, not necessarily expensive, I guess it was the carbon cost. Is that what that, how many tons of carbon? Is that what we were looking
at? That was the unit that I used, but there's a cost story to it as well.
Right. And so I was just curious how difficult it is to create that type of analysis and whether there are means that have been developed to maybe standardized to develop that kind of a structure. Because you can instantly see lots of difficulty in trying to justify those numbers. I'm just wondering if there's already a means developed that you can take refuge in and say, well, we used the fill-in-the-blank methodology.
It's possible to measure carbon using scientific methods and to positively identify whether one choice has more carbon emissions associated with it than another. On the economic side, you can get bids and you can demonstrate what one price is offered versus another, and you can compare both of those or other things to figure out if there's, what the best choice is, depending on whether your environmental goals are more important than your fiscal goals or vice versa, or it's a blend of the two. We find it's usually a mixed bag, but the information enhances the decision process because you feel more informed, you make a decision that's more pointed, and it's defendable, based on those goals. So in the case of the cement, and I want to make sure I get to your question, if you were asking, was the cement cheaper from China than from Durkee?
Hang on. Do you want to clarify your question, Representative Benz? Because I think that you were actually getting at something slightly different.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. What I was getting at is like a LEEDS device or some other device that has been or is in the process of being developed so that there's a standard template that's applied to each of these situations so that the methodology that is used in making that would be used in this pilot project, for example, is standard, as opposed to working one's way through it from that slide kind of indicated, well, there's so much here, so much here, so much here, because there's a lot of moving parts to that.
Sure.
And so that's my question.
For the carbon counting,
exactly,
in particular,
that's not
the final decision, but just the information gathering, comparing the Canada to the China. Is there a standard way of doing that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Benz, there are several protocols, official scientific protocols for carbon footprinting that are available in the world. We've identified one in this bill. I believe it's the World Resources Institute protocol that describes exactly how to baseline or to determine what you're measuring against and then how to both measure and demonstrate that you've done the proper measurement in each of these calculations. So the bill doesn't, I think it needs to be worked out exactly which standard is best and most appropriate for the bill, but there are many to choose from, and I think that they could quickly get with something that makes sense.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And let's hear next. Before you go, question from Representative Jensen. Sorry.
In the in the bill itself, in Section 4A, at B, and then A and B, talks about the construction company with which the department contracts must have experience in developing and managing individual construction projects in Oregon that have a value of at least $10 million, and two, have developed at least one leadership in energy and environmental design project that has achieved gold certification. How many construction companies qualify in Oregon?
I think
that.
Do
you have any idea?
I don't know exactly how many would. The lead accredited professional is a very common designation in the city. There, I would guess, hundreds of individuals that have that experience. Construction companies, you kind of have to take each of the tier, but I think that there are several companies that either by themselves or in combination with another expertise could fulfill the requirements.
Thanks very much. Let's move to Robin Kirkpatrick and Ellen Shepherd from DAS.
Representative Cannon, committee members, my name is Robin Kirkpatrick. I work for the Department of Administrative Services, the Facilities Division, and with me today is Ellen Shepherd from the Department of Administrative Services Facilities Division. Ellen is our subject matter expert as it relates to sustainability and what what DAS and the Facilities Division is doing along those lines. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here and testify on this bill this afternoon, and We have prepared some written testimony for you. What I will be doing this afternoon is just providing a few highlights of the testimony and giving you some information on the role that DAS Facilities believes that it can provide in trying to carry out the intent of this bill. DAS Facilities deals with the greenhouse inventory process. It's a collaborative effort in which we work with a number of agencies to try to capture information on greenhouse gas emissions from a number of aspects of state agency operation. Upon seeing this bill, we recognize there's another good opportunity here for an area in which there has not been a lot of analysis or work done, which does contribute perhaps significantly to the greenhouse gas emissions within the state. And what we are anticipating doing, if assigned this role of dealing with the pilot program, is to work with a number of state agencies that do have construction projects that meet the requirements of the bill, being 10 million or greater in size, and work with these agencies to try to implement a process where we can try to capture the kind of information that has been requested through this bill so that we can work towards developing some strategies. And I think the kinds of strategies will be strategies that can be followed as a major construction project is carried out to recognize the steps in the construction process that in fact do indeed impact the greenhouse gas emissions from a construction project. The strategies that we would develop through this process would be done by working with these agencies as they manage their own construction projects. Our effort would be to manage a collaborative effort to gather the information. It wouldn't be to manage each agency's project, but rather to work with them as they are carrying out their project. But it would be to apply a consistent process to each of a number of diverse projects and try to do so in a consistent way. So no matter what, whether it's a road construction project or a major facility construction project, that we could begin trying to see where the common factors are, the transportation, the employment factors, the materials factors, to see, you know, where are these projects impacting greenhouse gas emissions in the construction process. And so our role would be one of facilitating this this program, applying this data gathering process to a number of different projects, and then looking for the strategies that can be a result of that, working with tools like those that Ecologistics have just mentioned, certainly would enhance the our ability to meet the objectives of this bill, knowing that there are tools out there that are available for measuring the impacts on greenhouse gas emissions of each of these major construction project elements is real important. It would prevent us from having to reinvent the wheel, basically. So we believe it's an important part of the state government operations that presently isn't being incorporated to the extent it probably should be in identifying what the greenhouse gas emissions are. A concern that we do have is that the bill is requiring projects to be involved in this pilot program that are significant projects, and as you all are familiar with, the process of getting a state construction project of this size on the books and approved and be able to get it underway is not a real rapid thing, and that's why we would be suggesting that projects that are already being requested through the capital budget process be ones that be considered for projects to use for this program. If the committee would be inclined to move that direction, we would work very closely with each of the individual agencies that have projects that would meet the committee's requirements. to implement the pilot program with them to carry out this analysis. That's really, in a nutshell, what we see our role as being. We do have some recommendations that you'll see in the testimony. There are a couple of elements of the bill that we would hope to see a little clarification on, and they are identified. We do believe, as the summary of our testimony indicates, that this is really an important step for the state government to take. We believe that quantifying these emissions from construction projects will be very beneficial to the citizens of the state. As we develop the strategies and are able to apply them to a much broader spectrum of projects rather than just the few that we might use in a pilot program, we expect that we would see economic impacts occurring as we started applying these strategies. There would be more potentially local vendors who end up on the job and supplying materials, because when all else is equal, if going with a local firm reduces carbon footprint, reduces greenhouse gas emissions, then that certainly could be the deciding factor. And any major construction project, obviously there are many factors that need to be considered beyond the carbon footprint of the construction process. We believe it's an important piece to factor into that decision-making process, and the strategies that we would see coming from this bill would be a process that would encompass all of those major criteria, one of which would be factoring in the impact on the greenhouse gas emissions from the construction process. So that's basically what our position is. If there are any questions from the chair or the committee members, we would be glad to do our best to try to address those.
Any questions? I do have one. I came across an issue when I, along with Representative Clem, were exploring a local preferencing option, in fact, in that case for local jurisdictions, and this is a different bill moving related to primarily the food purchases, not construction contracting, but did run into some concerns, which I think we've successfully navigated around, related to reciprocity and consideration of if our state imposes a local preferencing requirement that other states might do the same. And again, and that different bill relates to local government, not state government. But is there any risk that you're aware of that by using a greenhouse gas approach the reality of which might be to favor local contractors and local suppliers, subcontractors and suppliers that we might have trouble with other states who are, take sort of punitive steps against Oregon suppliers, subcontractors, contractors. Has that thought crossed your mind at all?
Certainly. And any time you start looking at applying local preferences, that's an issue that you really have to have in the forefront of your thinking. And it's there's no simple answer to it. And obviously, any time you move towards that kind of a preference, you do raise the risk that you're going to have that kind of feedback. It's an important concern to keep in mind. Is the risk of reaching that threshold where you might start seeing that kind of action worth taking? It may or may not be, and I think that's something that hopefully we will be able to ascertain a little better after we carry out this pilot program, is if the benefits that we see as a result of developing these strategies, impacts on the greenhouse gas emissions, are quite significant, then as we go through building this as a consideration into the procurement process, that certainly will be a factor to keep in mind. But it might well indicate that the benefits seen from following this path, reductions of greenhouse gas emissions that are significant, are worth taking that risk level a little bit higher. And at the same time, you have to recognize that we're not the only state that has these concerns about greenhouse gas emissions and the impacts on their citizens. So as we move along this approach, what I would suggest is if it appears to be generating significant benefits for the state of Oregon, that we be proactive and try to provide the information on what we're doing to the neighboring states as well, so that they can, rather than being antagonists, they can try working with us collaboratively on a more regional basis to deal with those issues.
Well, thanks very much for your testimony, and I am interested in trying to move this approach along and would appreciate your continued help in identifying ways that any cost to the state could be mitigated through amending this bill. So your suggestions here are valuable. I think we should absolutely sort of try to piggyback on existing expertise and existing work that you're already doing, and if you have additional suggestions about how to minimize the fiscal impact, because I don't think many of us are prepared to vote for a project that would result in additional incurred costs for the state. But if we can shrink that with your help, I think we'd be interested in moving along. So thanks very much.
Okay. Chairman Cannon, committee members, we appreciate the opportunity. We look forward to working with the committee as the bill moves further along through the process, and any assistance that we can provide, we will be happy to do so.
Thanks. Quickly to Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just talk with you after about the fiscal part, because obviously I missed part of that. But I wanted to ask you, if this hasn't been asked, please, it has stopped me. Is this part of, your, if you have a mission statement or goal statement for your department already, is this something that's on your radar?
I would like to ask Ms. Shepherd to address that question, if she would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ellen Shepherd, the Sustainability Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. And this is something that we have been thinking about for a little bit. We weren't quite sure how to implement it in these budget times. So we've had it on our radar. We've been thinking about it as far as the capital construction piece. We do the greenhouse gas inventory for state government operations, and that takes into account several factors related to greenhouse gas emissions, but currently this is not one. However, it is on our radar as a good one to put on there in the future.
A follow-up.
So if we can't get there for lots of reasons in this session, climate, fiscal, whatever, is there anything preventing you from pursuing the intention of this bill in the department, or do you need legislative authority from us to do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, the best answer to that, I believe, is to let you know that we, in our efforts to deal with the building as efficiently, as cost-effectively as we can, we try already to take the steps that we can to try to build sustainably with as little impact on the environment as we can. The difference between what this bill is driving towards, as I see it, and what we're currently doing is that this is providing an opportunity for us to try to pull together a consistent process that can be applied to all state construction. As it is now, when we're looking at doing a new major project, each agency, as they're working on their individual project, will, in recognizing the impacts that greenhouse gas have and the concern about sustainability, try and build into the process as best they can. But really, as Ellen has said, it hasn't been on our radar screen very long to try to get support to build essentially a statewide process, a consistent strategy for looking at it that way. So it's a great opportunity to be able to do that.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on your question, too, is currently, while we're all struggling down here, that the ocean renewable energy sector is working hard on this very thing, and they've actually, Mr. Chair, you'll like this part, they've asked, how they can work with us, partner with us, and in all reality, some companies that could ship devices here are asking to partner locally to build them here in our coastal communities.
That's great. Well, thank you very much. I think we'll move along, but appreciate your time on this issue and look forward to working with you as we proceed.
Chair Cannon, committee members, thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3161 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2534. Let's begin with Ivan Lusky, and he can help explain this bill to us. Ivan.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Malusky. I'm with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club, and happy to talk about this bill today. I want to, before I start my comments, call to your attention a letter that was distributed to the committee. We had roughly 300 people submit comments in advance of this hearing. You could not be here today from all over the state in support of this bill and the concepts that are behind it. I have to issue a public apology to your committee administrator Beth Trino. I know she was bombarded with some of those, but I think we corrected that problem, and I'm going to go ahead and submit this letter and the 300 names and addresses of the citizens that comment in favor of this bill today with you all for the record.
In fact, Beth left town. She was so bombarded by your email. That's why Rick's here.
Well, again, my apologies for the record. So thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2534 today. This bill's intent is to bring greater transparency, consistency, and accountability to state agency environmental decision-making. It is meant to address the problem of state agencies operating under a patchwork of differing rules governing how they study and disclose environmental impacts of major decisions and how they involve the public in those decisions. It is also meant to provide the public with an avenue to prevent actions that would cause significant harm to the environment. This bill seeks to enhance environmental planning and coordination between agencies while preventing state agencies from making environmentally damaging decisions without adequate public input or analysis of less harmful alternatives. It is a tool to help ensure that state agencies are consistently incorporating the state's greenhouse gas reduction strategies into environmental planning, protecting air and water quality consistently, and enhancing Oregon's environment in the face of growing population and development in coming decades. Section 2 of the bill is written is based on the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, which requires that federal agencies analyze and disclose the environmental impacts of their actions while analyzing a range of alternatives. Passed by Congress in 1969 and signed into law by President Richard Nixon, NEPA is one of the nation's most important environmental laws. Its passage has become a model for similar laws and rules adopted in 100 foreign nations, in international treaties, and in 16 states, including Arkansas, South Dakota, Minnesota, Washington, and more. California's Environmental Quality Act was signed into law by then-Governor Ronald Reagan. I will go ahead and anticipate one of the criticisms that you may hear about this bill, that it leads to litigation. I think there is a lot of talk about that. I think the facts are that of thousands of decisions that the federal government makes using the National Environmental Policy Act every year, it results in roughly only 100 or 20 or so lawsuits, and the government often wins those. Sometimes plaintiffs win those. Ultimately, what this type of rule does is give us the opportunity to think about trade-offs and alternatives before we irretrievably put resources at risk, and to try to be collaborative at the outset. So while Oregon has been innovative in many ways in its environmental policies, we do not require state-level coordinated environmental planning that applies the same standard for public comment, transparency, and accountability to all state agencies to ensure that they're being consistent in addressing their responsibilities. We believe that with expanding population pressure and increasing threats of climate change, our ever-increasing scientific knowledge, and an increased desire by the public to address these issues, now is the time for Oregon to pass just such a law. I think again, I think that if we do this right, we're going to be given the opportunity for state agencies to be really looking at the trade-offs and alternatives before we commit state resources and make major decisions with regard to the environment. And ideally, this really kind of has to be collaborative and address the hard issues up front and early in the decision flow. The core concept of an Oregon Environmental Quality Act, not necessarily what you see in this bill, but I think of an ideal type of act, would be that one, proposed government decisions impacting the environment would be openly publicized in advance with adequate time allowed for public comment involvement. Two, for projects with potentially significant effects, agencies must look at a range of alternatives to analyze and an analysis of all environmental impacts, including impacts on water, air quality, fish and wildlife, and climate change issues. Decisions must ensure scientific integrity and reliability in the use of peer-reviewed science. Members of public and the citizens groups should have standing to seek judicial redress or some sort of administrative appeal process. and there should be an identification of categories of actions without without a potentially significant effect that could be subject to less rigorous environmental analysis or even excluded from such analysis when the action is relatively minor. So on that note, we believe that House Bill 2534 is a good first start, and it gets us part of the way there. A statute such as this ideally should be more specific, and I believe that you should have seen some -1 amendments that Representative Buckley submitted that attempt to bring a little more specificity to the public involvement process and strengthen the bill in a variety of ways. One of the key things it does is it clarifies that one of the elements of issues that should be looked at is cumulative effects. How does a certain action relate to other similar actions that have taken place in a similar geographic area? A requirement to disclose the science that was used to make these decisions. Creating a consistent process across state agencies for soliciting public comment and involvement in the development of these environmental impact statements, and clarifying that individuals and businesses, not only organizations, should have the right to seek some sort of redress. In addition to these types of changes, we think there are a few other elements that could make this bill into a highly effective and efficient tool for good environmental planning and the protection of Oregon's environment. I've listed some of those previously, so I won't go into it again. I think a couple that I haven't listed include... essentially, you know, you could look at potentially designating one agency as a lead agency that would certify compliance with this law by other agencies, creating an administrative appeal process somewhere short of the contested case that's spelled out, issue that's spelled out in the bill in order to resolve differences before going to court, and expanding the right to file an administrative appeal or contested case to include cases where there's a failure to conduct an EIS when it would otherwise be reasonably necessary. I guess in conclusion, I would like to say that it is worth noting that this year, 2009, is the 40th anniversary of the National Environmental Policy Act. So this provides extra significance to the discussion of House Bill 2534 today in the Oregon Legislature. And again, we wish to thank you for holding this committee hearing today. We look forward to continuing to work with you on this legislation and as the discussions move forward. Thank you. Happy to take questions.
All right, questions. Representative Boone.
Well, I have two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This appears to be a complete gut and stuff of the original bill. Is that true?
If you look at the bill, it's the Legislative Council did that. It's largely similar. I think the only difference is there's a few words here and there that are different. And I think the most significant additions are in the what's been added to the -1 is Section 3, which spells out the public process for publishing notice of a proposal for state action in agency publications and elsewhere, and which also spells out the time frame, a minimum time frame for environment, this sort of thing to occur. And then essentially the Section 5, which is to extend the ability to go to a contested case hearing to individuals, to persons, which in Oregon law is defined as individuals as well as businesses and corporations. So,
Follow up. But it is a complete gut and staff.
I think technically, yes, but I would point out that just two sections are different.
And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
In a Section 4, I guess, of the amendment, which is what it's proposing, one or more members, line 23, one or more members of an association or organization are adversely affected or aggrieved by the environmental impact statement, they can affect a hearing, but then it says that they do not have to attend such a hearing or participate in such action. I don't understand why.
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, my understanding is that this language is what Legislative Council put in there. It's from ORS 468.067, which specifically applies to this type of a hearing in Clean Air Act cases for Title V permit decisions that the DEQ is responsible for. So this language exists in Oregon law already, if I'm not mistaken, in ORS 468.067. It just sort of applies it in this type of a situation for more broadly.
Follow up. I understand that, but I guess I don't understand why would we want to change this to have affect that type of hearing where someone can request it from afar, for example, and then not have to participate in the activity of the hearing.
Well, that's a very good question. If I could ask a question, could you point me to? I guess I'm not seeing the exact line that you're looking
at. It's in both the bill,
mm-hmm.
the original bill, in Section 3, the entire Section 3, it discusses that would be removed by the amendment, and then in the amendment it says that the nature of the claim and the relief requested do not require that the members of the association or organization who are adversely affected or aggrieved participate in the contested case hearing.
Sure, can
I read that as saying someone could make a claim from afar, any organization. Someone in, let's say someone in Boston could file this claim for something here in Oregon, and they would not have to participate in the hearing. I don't understand why they wouldn't. Who would participate in that hearing?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, that's a great question. I'm not sure why exactly it's written that way. Again, my understanding is this is from Legislative Council and it exists already in Oregon in law. If I'm mistaken about that, I'd love to be corrected. And I think that would be a great amendment to look at to clarify. And I think that would be a good amendment to make.
That we get information.
Thanks, Representative Boone. Yeah, maybe we might get further information on that today, or we can look at that for a follow-up amendment.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks.
Other questions? I think it would be helpful to give the committee an idea of the types of projects or the types of state government actions that might be subject to this as you envision this process going forward. So we just heard a bill related to construction contracting. Well, you know, depending on how you look at it, that may have a big environmental impact, particularly if you're talking about a $10 million construction project. You know, in the range of possibilities, including things like the decision to build a, you know, state prison and how to build it, as well as maybe the decision on harvesting trees from a state forest, to land use decisions the state makes, which within that universe, would that all potentially be subject to the requirements of this bill, or is there a more focused set of agency actions affecting the environment, or an even broader universe of...
Chair Cannon, thanks for the question. As written, the bill really applies to state government agencies, so it wouldn't apply to localities as written. I know that Washington's law does apply to all government entities, counties and cities as well. I think that Oregon's got a somewhat unique case when it comes to land use planning, and there may be ways in which to take a look at this and how you could harmonize this or make sure this doesn't step on the existing land use planning process. That would be one consideration I think would be worthwhile to take a really good look at. I think that generally, though, when you're looking at agencies made by decisions made by state agencies, part of what we're suggesting is to clarify a little bit more the types of activities that would qualify for, you know, what we would consider to be a significant impact. And the bill does not define that as written. And I would submit, you know, that is quite open-ended and perhaps does need some more definition. One alternative is to do that through a rulemaking process that agencies would undergo to sort of come up with different categories where that threshold is met. It's partly why we're suggesting you look at ways to essentially categorize. Some actions may not need any sort of environmental analysis because they'd be relatively minor. Others might need something less rigorous. Something might need much more. I think at the end of the day, and then there's another complicating factor, and it's that some agencies have to operate under the federal NEPA process for some actions anyway. So, for instance, the Department of Transportation, because they use a lot of federal highway funds, they often have to go through a federal NEPA process when doing major highway widening. There was a case of the Highway 20 widening project outside of Corvallis, which ran into some very serious environmental problems. They had conducted an environmental impact statement through NEPA. It's our belief that you can harmonize a state process with a federal process in that case and try to do it in a way that really does ensure that Oregonians have a chance to participate. But you do want to look at it. You want to make sure you're not having duplicate processes and whatnot. I think that one other element I'd say is that, you know, some agencies, I think, do a better job of this because they're used to working with federal statutes on this. Others, I think, less so. I think in the area of forestry, you've got some situations where, you know, cutting is permitted on private land. We had a situation this winter near Eagle Creek where a neighbor's, you know, house was lost due to a landslide that originated by an ODF-approved cut on private land. That might be something that that would apply here, and I guess we'd have to sort of look at it more closely. Right now, the way the bill's written, it's not completely clear that it would apply to that situation.
Okay, it'd be helpful for me at least perhaps to follow up offline about the intent and you know, if we are at some point in time going to move forward, that this kind of approach be certain at least that we have a pretty clear understanding of the intent, and whether or not that's written to law or just reflected in the record, I think it's worth considering. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to try another angle maybe at at your previous question, thanks for being here, Ivan. I would say I was not aware of your admiration for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, but what are we trying to fix? I mean, we kind of went down a state coordination road, and then just now we went down a linking up to coordination with the feds.
Mm-hmm.
And you gave an example of one Department of Transportation thing. Can you give me an example of what we're trying to fix here?
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, thank you. Yes, in fact, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, if you look at the record, were two pretty significant environmental presidents, particularly Richard Nixon, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I think part of what we see as what we can fix here is that when you look at across state agencies, you really do see a patchwork of public involvement processes, and it's not always consistent. And I think that's one of the core things that we're trying to do here, is to create something that's consistent and transparent across a variety of state agencies. Now, my point about some of the federal hooks is that some agencies are used to doing this, and it may not require a lot of work to sort of meld that into a state process. I think other agencies really have a challenge, and I think that I think every year we look around December, we have serious flooding. Some of that is related to roads that were built inappropriately. Some of it is timber harvest practices. There are other issues. You know, I'm not trying to single out a certain industry here, but there's an example of an issue where I don't think that the public has really has much of an option when certain choices that some agencies make are made. Basically, we don't see a lot of detailed environmental analysis in some agencies. And so I think what we're trying to do with this bill is harmonize that across state agencies, so we have a consistent process, and that we're looking at it, everyone goes through the same sort of process.
Thanks very much. Oh, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill suggests that our current agencies aren't doing an adequate job, and that there's been a series of failures that would require this additional or more, I don't know what to call it, precise oversight. And I'm reminded of a couple of somewhat similar situations I've seen where the state developed a process that parallels the FERC process, for example, and ends up really just being along for the ride in meaning of the FERC relicensing of dam devices, for example. But what concerns me the most here is that in our state, much of what we would try to do is already stopped, halted, delayed, and we can't get there from here. And this device, although well-meaning, suggests another barrier to getting things ultimately done. But I'm all in favor of doing what we need to do to protect our environment. It's just that I wonder, this looks like an additional device that we don't need. And I say that after serving 8 years on the Water Resource Commission and watching how carefully that department did its job. I just wonder where you can point out to us the inadequacies of our current state agencies' activities. Because this bill suggests they must be huge. Because, just one last point, it seems to me that this is going to be a very expensive device, both at the agency level and in on the private side as we try to deal with it. So I just need to hear, I guess, why we need it. And some specific examples would be good.
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, very good questions. Try to get to all of them, and you can remind me if I miss one, okay? First, I think that different agencies are taking different approaches to solving environmental problems, and I think that one of the key elements here is to try to ensure that we're coordinating our environmental policies consistently. We have ambitious goals in the state to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. This might be a tool to make sure that agencies are really looking at that as they plan significant actions. I think that our hope is that this would not create another layer, or that where Oregon would just be along for the ride. I think that in some cases where we have to meet federal law, certainly that's going to be a big issue. I'll give you one example, though. The Department of Environmental Quality is responsible for implementing the Clean Air Act and issuing permits for Title V permit holders, so large, significant sources of pollution. I would like, you may want to ask them when they come up, are they looking at a range of alternatives? Is an alternative ever, no, we're not going to grant this permit for pollution for a variety of reasons, or is it simply on the environmental grounds? I think that part of what this does is ask that we look at a range of alternatives, that we have the informed information and science to back it up to say, is there a less environmentally damaging choice that we could be making here? And so that's an area where I think that we could see some improvement through a state process that really required that. And I think in terms of expense, I think, when I look at the issue of property damage related to poor management practices, land management practices, or roads that get washed out every winter because of inappropriately built roads or inappropriate management practices, I see a large cost to those, and I think that we don't often factor that in, and as well as the growing cost related, and we're going to see, I think, more impacts around climate change related issues compounding that, and I think that that's part of what we're hoping to get at, is really anticipate that at the front end. I think that there's a lot of value inherently in looking at those trade-offs and alternatives and trying to be collaborative from the get-go instead of finding ourselves after the fact, potentially in federal court, after resources have been committed, et cetera. So I hope I got to your questions there.
Mr. Fallon, sir. I appreciate I included too many in that question, and I thank you for your answers. I guess I want to go back to Chair Cannon's question about the scope of the bill. And is it your thought when you talk about roads washing out that that is on state land and not private land? This bill would not, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I guess my question is, how do you see this bill affecting private property?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bence, it's a good question. I think this bill has the potential to, if you look at the original bill as written, it's sufficiently vague that it actually doesn't answer that question. I think the dash ones go a little bit further, but I think that one could make a case that some activities on private lands that require state approval are of significant enough environmental impact across a broad range of spectra that there should be more of a public process that takes a look at, is this an appropriate action? And, the ramifications of that are a separate question, but I think that there are certainly arguments to be made if you see, roads washing out because of certain land management practices that was approved by the state, that the state bears some responsibility, and did we look at the landslide risk close enough? What kind of science were we using to justify that was okay to permit? Those types of things. So I don't think we should take that this could have applications for private land off the table. I think that the goal is to make it so that it's really only affecting significant actions on private land that require state approval.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Ivan. You've done an admirable job presenting the bill and dealing with all of our questions, so thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you again, Representative Cannon and the committee for hearing us today.
Let's move on. And before we have both proponents and opponents here, but before we get to them, I'm going to ask the four folks who I have signed up from state agencies to tell us a little bit more about what this means for them, or what they think it might mean for them. So Brenda Bateman, Amy Joyce, Greg Aldrich, and Mike Graney, if you can find a way to all four of you get up or near the dais, we'll hear from you as a group.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm with the Water Resources Department. Thank you for the opportunity to comment this afternoon on HB 2534. Excuse me, pardon my voice, which would require the Water Resources Department and other agencies to develop an environmental impact statement for major state actions significantly affecting the quality of the environment. The first thing we did when we read this text was to define, for purposes of our analysis, what a major state action might be coming from our agency. And so we identified new water right permits for above ground storage, that it would be reservoirs, for volumes above 3 million gallons. And we also looked at new permit applications for groundwater or surface water rights, asking for more than 1,000 gallons per day. That seemed a pretty bright line for us in terms of larger type projects. So using those parameters as a starting point, we went back and looked at the two-year calendar for 2007 and 2008 and found just over 100 such applications fitting those categories. The department does not currently have the staff to conduct the type of required environmental impact study that's envisioned by this bill or the Dash 1 amendments. We would likely meet these requirements by soliciting the services of private contractors. And so we asked for and received some quotes to get some ideas of the cost there. We were provided quotes in a range of $30,000 to $100,000 for each environmental impact statement that we would do under this exercise, plus some attorney general costs. So the results came out in a range between $3 million and $9.9 million for us for a biennium. And obviously, those were parameters that we started with. Those are open for discussion and negotiation, but that was something that seemed a pretty good starting point for us. We wanted to talk about the kind of review that we conduct today, because the department, as you know, is committed to the protection of our groundwater and surface water resources and the health implications that use of those resources has. Today, when we get a new application in the door, they are reviewed against four main criteria, the first being a water availability analysis to ensure that water is available for appropriation in the first place. This is both to protect the water resource and to reduce the burden on our enforcement folks to make sure that we're not asking them to go out and enforce in a situation where there's going to be even more scarcity. We look at the uses that are already coming from a water source, and we consider this to be a look at the cumulative effects, which was mentioned a little bit earlier in today's hearing. The second thing that we look at is a basin program review. Basin programs describe for us the types of uses that are allowed from a particular water source. We also do an injury review designed to protect senior water right holders. Those include in-stream rights and out-of-stream consumptive rights. And fourthly, we have other rules that we use so that we're asking for comment and consultation by ODFNW and other natural resource agencies while we're reviewing these permits. And we're also looking at the potential hydrologic connection between groundwater and surface water. So with these reviews in place, we believe that we already have a process designed to protect the environment. And in addition, there are opportunities today for other agencies and for the public to comment or to protest as we move these documents through the process. So we believe that requiring the type of environmental impact statement envisioned by this bill and the Dash 1 Amendment would be extremely costly for the state and would cause significant delays in our application processing and in the water right projects that they're designed to develop. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thanks, Brenda. Let's go ahead. I think we might hear some themes in our from our agencies. Let's go ahead and hear from the others and then move to questions. Greg, you want to?
Sure. Good afternoon. Noon, Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. I'm Greg Aldridge, Government Relations Manager at the Department of Environmental Quality, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And I would like to make some brief comments on the bill. General comments, and this sort of came out of Ivan's testimony, a key term in this bill is major state actions that significantly affect the quality of the environment is not defined. And that's very critical to define that because that triggers the environmental impact statement provisions. The term could be broadly interpreted to include permit decisions, rulemaking, and even budget decisions to reallocate resources. WRD just did a nice job of creating that bright line. We haven't been able to do that yet. The analysis required by this bill would be difficult to perform. Environmental impact statements, for instance, rely heavily on professional judgments or policy choices as opposed to hard science and clear data, making them more susceptible to legal challenges and at least harder to defend. A clear example of this can be found in Section 2.3d, where DEQ would be required under the environmental impact analysis to evaluate the relationship between local short-term uses and the maintenance and enhancement of long-term productivity. Very broad terms. This provision appears to ask DEQ to assess the cumulative impact of multiple local decisions on the health of the larger environment, something we currently don't do. And while this assessment may be important when making environmental decisions, it's a difficult analysis to be performed because of the lack of hard science and clear data. So thinking about our permit process, because that's one of the most typical things people run up against, the bill's provisions would slow down the permit process by, one, the amount of time it takes to draft the EIS, and then the length of time it takes between the issuance of the draft EIS and issuing the final EIS, so another time component, and then the final agency action. This, we're sure, would be longer than our current public review process. And then, of course, if there's an appeal process, that would further delay the issuance of the permit. The longer-term impact would also slow down the process, as draft permits could get backed up waiting for special studies that are often triggered by EISs, say, in California, for toxicological reports, modeling, and other resources to become available so that you can do the alternative life cycle analysis or cost-benefit analysis that's often envisioned. Not try to repeat other things. For a fiscal impact, we didn't go through the quantitative analysis, but just some things to think about from our perspective, looking at air quality. The depth of the fiscal impact will depend on how the environmental impact statement provisions are implemented, as well as the definition of what that major state action significantly affecting the environment. Under a worst-case scenario, resources would be required to do toxicological support for localized impact analysis, modeling support, again, for local impact analysis, alternative analysis, and life cycle or cost-benefit analysis to specifically address Sections 2, D, and E of the bill. Currently, we do not have the resources to provide those services. Whether we would have to contract out, like WRD suggested, or hire people, it obviously would take additional funding and resources that we currently don't have. What does it mean in terms of what we're doing now? And this is something Ivan had brought up. In air quality, we currently have existing review reports for permit decisions found in Section 2, A and B, in the original bill, that set forth the permitted and actual emissions to air quality for each facility and the impacts of those emissions. However, the report does not detail or address localized impacts of those emissions, and we really don't have the details to go into much more than a cursory review. The existing review and air quality permit program that would not even address items C, D, and E of the EIS, so it would be a major expansion. This is not a judgment that it's not good to expand, but it's just not part of something we do today. Ivan had specifically mentioned DEQ and whether or not we do alternative analysis, and it's true, for most permits we don't. We receive a permit, we review the permit, make sure it applies and it adheres to all the environmental requirements, and if it does, we issue the permit. We don't go back and second guess if there's another way they could do the process or whether or not there's even a need for the permit. Something could be done, but it's something we don't do now. And finally, for contested cases, we would need to set up an appeal process for litigation. It's something we do currently do because of Clean Water Act contested cases. It is something that has taken a lot of time from the staff and from those who are involved in the process, especially with the ability to have third-party lawsuits. So just wanted to throw that out there. And with that, I will end my comments and be open to any questions when you've heard the whole panel.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation, handed out some written testimony. The Department of Transportation understands that its current compliance with federal NEPA requirements fulfills the standards of House Bill 2534. The department has to satisfy NEPA on any project that uses federal dollars because of that federal nexus. because the source of funds can sometimes change over the life of a project, the department simply assumes that we have to go with the assumption that a federal nexus may occur, and therefore we comply with NEPA on all of our projects, even if it starts out as being purely state-funded. Most of our projects under that NEPA system result in what's called a categorical exclusion. That is a determination that, based on past experience with similar projects, similar circumstances, that an EIS, environmental impact statement, is not required. Perhaps 5% of our projects end up with what's called an environmental assessment, which is an environmental review of the process to determine if an EIS is necessary. And then perhaps 2-3% of our projects end up with a full-blown environmental impact statement. Average cost to do an EIS for the Department of Transportation is about $3 million. To do that environmental assessment, that lesser process, to see if an EIS is necessary, in the neighborhood of $1.5 million. And an EIS that we perform, it's lengthy, it's methodical, it's expensive, and it, at its core, is the openness and the solicitation of comment and involvement by the public. So, you know, NEPA has 40 years exactly now of regulations, federal regulations implemented and case law. At the start of NEPA, when it first went into effect in 1970, there was an 8-year gap before the federal government implemented its regulations. So there was about 8 years of lots of inconsistency, lots of not knowing what agencies needed to do, and folks were all over the map. And then since then, there's been federal regulation and lots of case law on what is meant by the terms in federal NEPA statute and what agencies are required to do. So one of the concerns we have based on the testimony that was already heard today is that there seemed to be an indication that compliance with federal NEPA would not satisfy the requirements of the bill. So I think that's something that would need to be discussed and figured out, because the department was of the understanding that compliance with the federal law met the requirements because the language of the bill so mimics the federal law. And we do, too, have concerns with the provision for contested case hearings. It will probably result in more litigation. With no demonstrated environmental advantage, the NEPA process is rigorous in providing opportunity for public comment. And folks, if they are dissatisfied with the process within NEPA, are entitled to, you know, they may file a federal lawsuit. And so we could see certainly duplicative litigation. That's what I have.
Thanks very much. Director Graney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. I want to address a different issue, and that is a caution or a concern about whether a NEPA approach would actually provide more environmental protection or not compared to the current standards the states use. And I provided for you a copy of the siting standards for large energy facilities that our Energy Facility Siting Council uses. The Department of Energy provides staffing to the council. Let me add that in my youth I worked on NEPA cases for a federal agency, so I value NEPA and I do see the importance of it. But based on the experience we've had with federal agencies using NEPA, particularly in siting LNG facilities, I think that you don't necessarily get the protections that you might think you would be getting through the NEPA process. We mentioned a couple things specifically. The siting council process that we have, our siting council has more than 20 different standards. There's 13 general standards there that are listed in those materials that apply to all energy facilities, and then specific standards such as for wind, different standards for transmission lines, different standards for pipelines, and for different types of other energy facilities. Those standards are pass-fail. You either meet the standard or you don't, and in order to get a site certificate, you have to meet them all. So the applicants know that. Any concerned citizens would know that. They would know what the parameters are that have to be met. Siting Council, if it approves a site certificate, it conditions that certificate on compliance with those standards, and there are frequently extensive conditions and follow-up monitoring that we have to do to assure that those conditions are met. Our standards have resulted in approval of many power plants over the years, including most recently, the last few years, a large number of wind energy facilities. But at the same time, we have there have been 4 natural gas plants, one in Klamath County, one in Central Oregon, one just outside of Eugene, and one just south of Salem here in Turner, and a wind farm proposed for the Columbia River Gorge that were all terminated, either by the siting council or by the developers themselves, when it became clear that those facilities could not prove compliance with these standards. Our process also includes, it's a centralized process, so it includes the standards of other state agencies, and we apply the standards of local governments as well. And so we condition the site certificate, again, on the conditions for compliance with other state agency standards and local standards. In contrast, when we were preempted by FERC, or by Congress, for FERC to take the lead on LNG facilities, LNG did use a NEPA process, and they have used it in each of the three cases that are pending. They've used it very painstakingly procedurally for the Bradwood case that is completed and is now under appeal in court. But FERC refused to adopt state standards. And in particular, the state agencies were concerned about impacts on water quality, impacts on estuarine impacts on fish in the Columbia River, financial qualifications of the applicant to assure site restoration and ability to operate the facility safely, carbon dioxide standards, a needs standard, and other standards. FERC did not use those. FERC used its own standards, which we think provide substantially less protection. FERC did do an analysis of alternatives, we think an inadequate analysis. The fundamental issue, I guess, I have with whether NEPA provides additional protections is NEPA provides a balancing act. It allows the agency to decide whether the costs outweigh the benefits. And that's a comparison of apples and oranges. You're comparing the benefits of whether it's additional power, whether it's a source of fuel, versus the environmental impacts. And that's a judgment that I suggest it's a technical judgment. It's also a judgment that gives the agency a lot of discretion. And I think in the case of FERC, it was a very unsatisfactory process, whereas the standards process does not give the agency that kind of discretion. I think both sides know what the determination is by the agency as to each of those standards. And we certainly have appeals of our siting council decisions at times, but the issues are clearly limited and factually based on whether a specific standard was met or not. So, Mr. Chairman, while we don't have a position specifically on the bill, just we do have some concerns that I wanted to lay before you.
Thanks very much, Director. Questions?
How's the... Before I ask a question, how's our list? Do we have other
folks? We do have other folks, so we're probably about right on time to get out of here by 5. And before I dismiss this panel, just a couple of comments, and if anybody cares to respond, that would be fine. What it sounds like what I'm hearing is, at least in some cases, and Director Green, I'm thinking of your testimony in particular, the state NEPA may provide less rigorous environmental protections than the process that we currently have on the books. So that's comment one. Comment two is that I heard certainly in Ms. Bateman, her testimony, and probably Greg, it would be the accused perspective as well, that it would cost a lot more money for the state to thoroughly evaluate actions that have a major impact on the environment and to provide this forum for public comment and review. And I think that's instructive piece of testimony, and I think it presents that question for our consideration. Perhaps, you know, in this session, we're not in the position, everybody understands, we're not in the position to be thinking about spending lots more money, but if the testimony is that in some cases, on some types of state actions, adequately protecting the environment and adequately creating a forum for the public to consider the environmental impact would require additional state resources, that's something that we ought to put in the back of our minds and think very seriously about. Again, probably not in this biennium where we appear not to be in that position to even consider it. But thank you very much for your testimony. And,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll share, yeah, Representative, Warren, Representative Bailey. Question. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious for the agencies for whom it makes sense. I'm just curious if you currently, in your analysis, you do incorporate greenhouse gas emissions into your environmental impacts.
Mr. Chairman, we do for large energy facilities. That's a state standard.
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, I have ODOT's NEPA expert here in the room who could better speak to the specifics than I could, if you'd like that.
Yeah, if we could just get a quick answer to that question. Meanwhile, we'll get Brenda.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do not.
And we're just beginning to.
This may be most effective. If you want to quickly introduce yourself for the record. And
Greg Holthoff, ODOT. NEPA coordinator.
And did you hear the question from Representative Bailey, or do you want to ask it again, Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious to know if as ODOT is going through its analysis of environmental impacts of given projects of greenhouse gas, is currently one of the criteria that is included in that environmental impact assessment.
Right now, we don't have policy internal to ODOT on greenhouse gases and how we will assess them. We're in the process of determining what our policy will be, and right now it's project specific on an EIS level. If greenhouse gases were to emerge as a key issue in the project at hand, then we would do probably a quantitative analysis. The CRC, the Columbia River Crossing EIS, is probably the best example of an EIS that's looking at greenhouse gases.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Representative Smith, you all managed to jump in right as I'm about to dismiss a panel.
You're timing it well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Greene, appreciated your testimony, sort of the challenge of balancing the length of a stick with the weight of a stone, right, and appreciated that. A question I have that remains extant is the degree to which greater coordination would be helpful, whether or not this is the vehicle for that coordination. And I don't necessarily need an answer to that immediately, but that's still a question I have. And then the other is more perhaps a strategic question for our chair. This is Representative Buckley's bill.
Yes.
Do we have any signals of what might happen to our other bills, the referred ways and means, depending on our
disposition? I think it's I would take it as very good guidance that it would be worth having a conversation with Representative Buckley before making any final decisions with respect to this bill.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to bring up several panels. So we, I think, have two panels of, well, one of three and one of four, perhaps, before we get out of here. So that'll give our audience a sense of the amount of time that they have, probably just a couple of minutes each, to address the issue. And I'm just going to go in the order that I have them here. Let's start with Tom Gallagher, Jeff Stone, John Chandler. Well, we'll just take those three.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing a number of clients here from Portland General Electric to Schnitzer Steel to the Portland Business Alliance. I take this bill and the intent behind this bill very seriously, that environmental impacts are going to become a greater significant interest to all of us as we move forward. We're spending a lot of time right now, Representative Bailey, on carbon administration, carbon planning. I'm not exactly sure that NEPA is the best model for doing this. I had a number of questions about the bill, which I'm not going to go through. I think the agencies and Ivan Lasky discussed a number of those. I'm assuming that the bill is going to apply to permitting. And the basic elements of the bill are process, public involvement, scientific definition, and environmental impacts. The long-term environmental problem really, in most cases for my clients, comes from unknown environmental impacts. At the time the action was taken, it was a seemingly reasonable action, and the result and ramification of that has been catastrophic in terms of cleanups on the Columbia River, the Willamette River, emissions into the atmosphere, and so forth. So it is smart and good business to begin to look forward to some of the actions that we take to see and understand more about those impacts. In terms of the specifics of this bill, if you go forward with the bill, it's going to need significant tightening of definitions. It's going to need a great deal of interplay among existing processes. Permit processes do consider most of these impacts right now, so I'm not sure what overlay it puts on it. The last thing I'll say is I'm not sure if this just applies to the environmental agency or it goes across the board with all state agencies. There's been many times that we've come forward and argued that the cumulative impacts of a certain activity results in more detriment than the activity we're trying to regulate. We too often look at things in a silo and don't go through all of the ramifications of those actions. If there's a way to get those processes to do that, to make more sense out of the negative impacts of certain restrictions, even things that look slightly bad in the first place, which are regulated in a specific way, can result in greater environmental impacts in other parts of the processes as we go down the line in the way that those activities are carried out. So if you're going to move this bill, it seems like we're going to have to spend a great deal of time looking at the details of how it's written. Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. In 1973, when Senate Bill 100 was passed, I was a junior in high school. I want to state that for the record just because I'm going to do my old guy imitation here for a bit, but I wanted to at least clarify that at the time that happened, I wasn't yet an old guy. The kind of unspoken deal when Senate Bill 100 was passed, that's the state land use implementing statute, was that instead of a NEPA, SEPA-style environmental impact-driven, contested case-driven process, we in Oregon were going to do a planning-based process. We have, of our 19 statewide planning goals, quite a number that address the issues that are being presented in this bill. We have Goal 3 for agricultural lands, Goal 4 for forest lands, Goal 5 for natural resource, open space, historic, Goal 6 for water quality, Goal 7 for natural hazards, Goal 8 for recreation property, Goal 13 for energy, Goal 14, urban growth boundaries. Those all were intended to address the exact issues that this bill is talking about, of the balance, the interplay, the way we address environmental issues, and we took a different path than the rest of the country. And we did that very deliberately. We did that for the reason we thought planning-based, cooperative-based, thinking through ahead of time-based system was preferable to the one that the federal level or the state of Washington uses with SEPA, which tends to be a little more confrontational, a little more litigation-driven, and much less effective, I believe, in actually providing the protections that this bill is seeking to advance. Point of all that, Mr. Chairman, is that if we're going to change our mind now and say that we're going to do a SEPA-type system, we're going to look at environmental impact statements, and we're going to move away from this planning-based, and under the land use statutes, there's all sorts of requirements for interagency cooperation, for land use compatibility statements, for making sure that these goals, and maybe they need to be beefed up, and there's all sorts of bills this session that could do that. Maybe we need to look at how our land use system operates and maybe provide more of an impetus. Point is, the tools are there. And if we're going to decide we don't want to use those tools, we're going to shift to a different one, as Mr. Gallagher said, we need to think through the details of that. And one of the things that we will do, for example, is we'll come in and say, if we're going to do impact statements, if we're going to go down that path, then let's go talk about the land use system and whether we need it anymore. Because, frankly, it was in 1973, and realize it's a long time ago, it was sort of an either-or discussion. And I was not here then. I've simply learned this. I wasn't paying attention to land use in 1973. I won't tell you what I was paying attention to, but it wasn't land use. It's a different approach than what we've done in Oregon. And I understand the need, I understand the motivation, I believe, and I don't necessarily quarrel with it. I would encourage you to look at the existing frameworks we have, make them work better if that's the intent, not change frameworks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Mr. Stone.
Mr. Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I won't bear to repeat much of what you've already heard, but state agencies charged with overseeing the state environment and natural resources already have stringent public interest review or similar processes. The public, as well as adversely affected aggrieved parties, are invited to participate in the process. And so the nursery industry is in favor of leaving all core environmental and natural resource programs in place and strengthening the agency's ability to implement and follow through with existing programs. I might also add is that we grow concerned about, in particular, Water Resources Department and Department of Environmental Quality, the impact on their budgets. That's a common theme throughout this session, but we wanted to raise it. And why do we care? On a daily basis, the state's nursery and greenhouse industry must contend with delays in water right processing and other permitting decisions, and this legislation could potentially add additional administrative burden without the corresponding increase in staffing or budget, and that's a significant concern to our growers. We don't want to just leave this and walk away. We want to join Mr. Chandler and others and roll up our sleeves and try to help you craft a bill that will get to the ends that you want to reach. And I think that you heard from the state agencies this afternoon about the wide-ranging impact it will have on its budgets. We take that very seriously. So we want to sit down with you and other stakeholders and get to work. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher. I'd add one last thing. I thought John was going to do it in Section 4. The concept of having an agency and a permitting process and a public involvement in it and so forth, a system we've set up, to have the system trumped, as it were, by the ability of third parties to do lawsuits, that one system or the other, that makes more sense.
Thank you. Any questions for this set of panelists?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be of interest to, in response possibly to Jeff's or Mr. Stone's remarks, to see what the three of you think about this broader planning concept, because either we have the separate approaches to each resource that we seem to have now, and the missing overall coordination, which is what this bill, I think, is trying to get at in one way or another. Are you guys suggesting that overall coordination piece isn't necessary, or are you suggesting that there's something that we ought to be thinking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, we've been supportive over the years of increased coordination on natural resource issues. We've made several runs at that in water, the context of water regulation, in the context of natural resource regulation generally, without notable success so far, but it's very definitely needed. We tend to have agencies functioning in silos. And whether it's a Washington-style DOE or other states have other models, the issues are no less contentious regardless of the organization. But we definitely believe there could be better coordination where you're looking at water issues, whether and being able to balance within one entity, whether water, other natural resource, mining, what have you. It's needed. I don't think to do that you have to go to this kind of a system. I think you could do that within the confines of our existing system quite adequately without buying the other rewrite of Oregon natural resource law that this bill would envision. But that, when I said that, that does not mean we don't think that better coordination is necessary, because we do.
Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher here again. John and I are probably the only two graduates of the regulatory streamlining and agency coordination endeavors of the past four sessions. We've introduced bills in three of the last four sessions to do this. One of them was on land use and the land use appeals process and attempting to integrate industrial lands into that. It generated a large work group that worked through a year and a half and came to no conclusion. The last one I did was on fill removal permits, which had seven agencies trying to cooperate. And it truly was a graduate course in where we are inside of agencies right now. Let me give you just quickly three of the major issues we came up against. Number one, they all had enabling statutory rights. So to get coordination and so forth, you have to find a way to work your way through those different statutory pieces. That is time-consuming and difficult, but it could be done. Number two, they had funding sources, and the funding wasn't transferable. So you ended up with significant problems because one agency had resources to do something, the other agency didn't have resources to do it, but the agency without the resources had the authority. And number three, the agencies themselves, in all goodwill among these seven agencies, getting coordination was extremely difficult and impossible despite their best efforts. And that's human nature. I think those things are possible. We're going through a whole another round of regulation from the command and control regulation of the early 80s. We're moving into a different area. What we're looking at right now in the discussions on carbon is a much more integrated planning approach. Everybody's getting smarter, and everybody's going to do those things. And I think when the Sierra Club brought this bill, they've been part of those discussions. I think their intentions and the way to work those things out are somewhere out in the future, but they're things we should work at.
I just will quickly add that, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, it's all about the problem you want to solve. And really, I think that's what we're trying to get at here. And what you don't want to do is set up inadvertently a debilitating system. And you already heard from the agencies today that the average EIS was something along the lines of $3 million. What you don't want to do is make it so cost prohibitive for any type of project in this state to completely get weighed down by the cost factor alone. So that I just would like to add that.
Yeah, and I thank you for the comment. It's well taken. I think, if I'm recalling, the Water Resources Department testimony, it was the average EIS was $30,000, but they were estimating 100 that would have triggered under there. So they came up with the 3 to 9 million figure that way. But thanks. Let's move on to final panel. Ray Wilkerson. This will be a panel of four, so you'll have to crowd. Ray Wilkerson, Andrew Hawley, Terry Witt, and Jim Welsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. What we've submitted, I wasn't sure whether to check with the Everett testimony or not to be appropriate, because what I've submitted and will be coming around to you is a photograph, and this would be under the category of a picture's worth 1,000 words, so I'll not speak 1,000 words, but it is a photograph of what the end result of a federal environmental impact statement process looks like. This is on a proposed thinning project on a federal forest in Montana. And I think this is an illustration of what the state of Oregon would face if it went down this road and adopted a similar law. At the very least, you would have a substantial number of state employees spending a substantial amount of their time not only writing these things, but the rest of their time in a courtroom defending them. And I don't know this for a fact, but based on a lot of years working on federal environmental or natural resource policy and politics, I would be willing to wager that by a large margin, most the number one type of federal environmental lawsuits are challenges to environmental impact statements written in compliance or lack thereof, depending on the allegation with the National Environmental Policy Act. So this is just a ticket to endless process and litigation, and at least that's been the experience at the federal level, and I think the picture kind of illustrates that. And the picture is just one relatively minor proposed project on a national forest in Montana.
Since I'm glad you're here, and since you have some experience with the federal process, do you have a sense of what percentage of federal actions trigger one of these EIS statements? We had the 2 to 3% from ODOT. Is that your experience as well, that you only get to this stage of development of you know, this stage of work in 2 to 3% or is it something much different than
that? Mr. Chairman, I don't have a number on that. For the part of the world that I work in, which is forestry, It appears at least to be a much higher percentage than that. I mean, particularly on national forest activities. The U.S. Forest Service can't turn around without having to file an environmental impact statement and then getting sued because of allegations that it wasn't done correctly. But that's just anecdotal. I don't have a number.
Thanks. Let's go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt with Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll try to not cover ground that's already been covered. I find it kind of ironic in some ways that if you look at what the bill is purporting to do, that it requires an environmental impact statement for all planning and decision-making that may, and I think that's the operative word, may have an impact on the environment. Looking at that definition, I'm not sure what activity by a natural resource agency would not have a potential impact on the environment and therefore potentially be subject to requiring an EIS. Parts of the bill that really give me heartburn is Section 3, for example, which allows any individual who doesn't even have to be an Oregon citizen to file the complaint, so to speak. And I think it was alluded to by Representative Boone that a person from Boston could file the complaint, wouldn't even have to show up for the contested case hearing. Somehow that seems to be very inappropriate and very costly. When I came to Oregon back in the late 80s, the first chore that I was given by Oregonians for Food and Shelter's board was to try to mediate an EIS with the U.S. Forest Service on the use of herbicides for vegetation management. That process took, prior to my arriving in Oregon, took 6 years. The Forest Service was enjoined from using any herbicides during that entire process. And it finally, the only way it came to resolution was OFS as an intervener and the other activist groups that were opposed to the use of chemicals were forced into a mediation by the courts. And that mediation took several months to accomplish. But the bottom line was, if we talk about expenses as an intervener alone in that six-year endeavor, OFS spent over $500,000 as an intervener, not as the principal party. EIS litigation is very, very expensive, and it's very time-consuming. And I think if we're looking at costs, unfortunately, the challenges to the EIS have really been for two reasons. And I think the primary reason that most of the time the EISs are challenged is because it is a delay tactic. It's a very significant delay tactic. As I said, with regard to vegetation management by the Forest Service, it was a six-year delay tactic. Think about the harm and that was done to the productivity of our Forest Service lands by not properly managing vegetation for a period of over 7 years by the time it was over. So it's not just the cost of compliance or even the cost of litigation, it's also the cost of delay. And I would just urge the committee and the legislature to take a very, very close look at the fiscal impact of undertaking an activity of this nature. I somewhat jokingly said in my comments that perhaps the supporters of this bill were trying to introduce a stimulus package, but unfortunately the only stimulus that I see is the benefit of environmental lawyers. And I would hope that that this concept takes a lot more fine-tuning before it's considered for passage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Cannon and committee members, Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen and the Oregon State Grange. And I would certainly ditto the comments from Terry Witt and Ray Wilkerson. We see this as a duplicative effort that we presently have enough regulatory requirements to probably take care of everything we need to, and I think about what our cattle producers have to go through right now. I know of at least six, probably court actions, and in a process of trying to justify the use of grazing lands, federal land and state land, and the more that we involve here in environmental impact statements, the more process, the more cost, and the more time delay that's involved. And I see that as occurring or as a direct result of this legislation. We don't think this legislation is needed, and I would much rather, if there's a definite problem, you know, be able to really zoom down on that problem in the processes that we have today with our state agencies and the oversight, and especially around environmental impact process, and zoom in on those and make some corrections if they're necessary, instead of something so broad as this that I see this as definitely a great example of a bill that definitely shows us that enough is not enough.
Thank you. Mr. Hawley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Hawley. I'm the Conservation Director for the Northwest Environmental Advocacy Center. I'm sorry, Defense Center. New job. For 40 years, NEDC has worked on behalf of Oregon's environment and natural resources. I'd like to add my voice in support of this bill and the intent and the action that the committee has taken with moving forward with this bill, and the opportunity that it presents to increase the transparency, consistency, and accountability that will result in agency decision making. Oregon is well known for its protection of the environment, and a bill such as this stands to provide a great opportunity to not only specifically embody Oregon's environmental commitment in legislation, but it'll improve decision making, agency decision making, improve the opportunity for Oregonians who may be impacted by an agency decision to participate in the process. Listen, it's time for Oregon to follow the example that was set by NEPA and the other states that have passed similar NEPA bills to require agencies to take the stop, look, and listen approach to decision making. this approach will benefit Oregon in three specific ways. First, it will explicitly articulate the environmental ethic that we Oregonians hold in legislation, and will place these considerations on a level playing field with the other similar mandates that agencies currently have, and thus allow, in the decision-making process, the agency to pick the least harmful environmental alternative when it's reasonable and feasible. Second, it will improve the agency decision-making process because agencies make the best decisions when they're working with complete and reliable information. Thus, an analysis of the alternatives, the cumulative impacts, the potential indirect impacts, and the frank discussion of any environmental impacts that will result after mitigation and minimization will allow the agency to make the best decision possible. And finally, it will allow the public the opportunity to involve itself in these decisions in a reliable and consistent manner so that they will understand the information that's being analyzed by the agency and have an opportunity to comment and assess that information themselves. That type of agency decision-making will allow the agencies to make the correct decision and not get themselves into a position where they make an incorrect decision that leads to an environmental harm that they later have to go back and try and remedy at much greater cost than would have been incurred at the outset. If I could just for a moment address a specific comment on Section 3 of the bill that's come up a couple times with regard to the question of who may or may not enter in a contested case. Example was that someone from Boston would be able to come in and challenge an agency action, and that's not actually the way the bill is written. What Section 3.3 refers to organizational standing, and when an organization is a representative of one of its members, for the organization to be able to come in and have standing to challenge an agency action, it must show that one of its members was affected. But for the organization to move forward with that action, it can't be an action where the member's individual participation is required, so it can't be a contract claim, or if the member was harmed in some way where they specifically have to be a party to that action. What it's saying is that the organization can speak for that member. And so it's not the situation where a person can come in from the outside and just begin a contested case process that would solely be to delay or something along those lines. It's simply a construct of the organizational standing requirement. And so I'm sure as you go back and look at that, that'll become more clear. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Thanks for that clarification. Are there any questions for this group? Yeah, Representative Boone.
And I just wonder how many other states have this legislation, this policy?
I believe it's 16 or so at this point.
And follow up? And I know we've heard some of the agencies come forward with cost estimates and stuff, but when the bill was written, did anybody do any kind of fiscal analysis of what this would cost?
I don't know if you, Mr. Holly, have an answer to that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, I don't have an answer to that.
Maybe something we can take up with Mr. Mosby offline.
Okay.
Thanks. Any other questions? Great. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill, 2534. And I did not quite get it in the record that we had dozens of comments submitted in support of this bill, but I think they are reflected in the committee record. And before I close the hearing altogether, I want to ask committee members to be here on time on Thursday. We have a very full agenda, including a work session that we'll try to do right at 3 o'clock, and then a long afternoon of testimony, mostly on ethanol-related issues and a number of bills that we're considering then. So please ask that you're here right at 3. With that, close the House Committee on Environment and Water.